When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm thrilled to have back with me today Dr. Juanita Henao, who, as listeners may remember, is the chief of OB anesthesia at the University of Oklahoma School of Medicine. We did a great podcast a little while back and are now back for another. Today, we're going to be talking about a really important and highly tested topic within OB anesthesia, and that is hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. Now, before I welcome Dr. Henao, I want to remind listeners that we do have coming up, faster than I can believe, a live, in fact, the first ever live ACRAC podcast. It's going to be on April 24th here at Johns Hopkins. And if you are interested in coming, there won't be a charge, but I would like to get a feel for people who are interested in coming. And so please, if you are interested in coming to that show, send an email to acrac@acrac.com and we'll give you more details. All right, let's get on with the current show. Dr. Henao, welcome back.
Thank you, Jed. Thank you so much for having me back.
All right. So we're going to talk, as I said, about hypertensive disorders of pregnancy. So why don't I start by asking you to just give us a list of what those are, and then we'll talk about them one by one.
Sure. So the hypertensive disorders of pregnancy, we basically have four categories. So we have chronic hypertension, which is hypertension that is present before pregnancy, before 20 weeks of pregnancy, to be more precise. And then we have gestational hypertension that presents after 20 weeks of pregnancy and is defined by a systolic pressure greater than 140 millimeters of mercury and a diastolic greater than 90 millimeters of mercury on two occasions, 4 hours apart, without the presence of proteinuria.
And Juanita, let me just ask you, so is it if your systolic is greater than 140 or your diastolic is greater than 90, or do you have to have both, or how does that work?
I think it's just one. Just okay. One of them, yeah.
And so either one will qualify.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
And then we also have chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia, so patients that had hypertension prior to pregnancy, but then they develop new onset proteinuria or other manifestations of preeclampsia. And last but not least, we have preeclampsia, eclampsia and HELLP syndrome, which are like categorized in the same spectrum. And this is like the most high yield, the most likely to be tested in the boards.
Right. And this comes up all the time on, as you say, in training exams, board exams. I don't know this for a fact, but I would bet it's the most highly tested topic in OB anesthesia.
Probably.
All right, great. So you said that there are a few kind of before, and maybe we'll save preeclampsia for last, since that is definitely going to be the one that's going to have the most detail. So chronic hypertension is kind of what you said, and what it is, right, is that this is a person who before they were pregnant, or I guess officially before 20 weeks of pregnancy, already had hypertension. And is that defined the same way? So this is a woman who is now pregnant, who is prior to 20 weeks and has either a systolic greater than 140 or a diastolic greater than 90?
Yes, but they don't have proteinuria.
Okay.
It's worth saying that both patients that have chronic hypertension and gestational hypertension have around 1/4 of a chance of developing preeclampsia. So these patients have to be monitored closely, for new onset proteinuria or other manifestations of preeclampsia.
And when you say 1/4, you mean a fourth of patients with?
With either disorder, exactly, with either chronic hypertension or gestational hypertension.
Okay, so that's quite high. So if you have gestational hypertension or chronic hypertension, you have a 25% chance during any given pregnancy of developing preeclampsia.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so obviously these are patients to keep a close eye on. Now, let me ask you this. What about a patient who is on antihypertensive medications and so does not have a blood pressure greater than 140 over 90, but obviously they would count, I would imagine, right, as a chronic hypertensive?
Yes, they will.
Okay. So that's chronic hypertension, pretty self-explanatory. Gestational hypertension is the only difference, same thing. So greater than 140 over 90 on two separate occasions without proteinuria. It's just that it starts after 20 weeks of pregnancy?
Correct.
Okay. And we say that that additional piece about no proteinuria, which is not something we think of with regular, people who are not pregnant, we don't measure for proteinuria. I don't think, I'm not a primary care doctor, but I think if you have high blood pressure, it's not with or without proteinuria. So that's something unique to pregnant patients. And why do we care about that? Why do we specify that these two, either chronic hypertension or gestational hypertension, is without proteinuria?
Because, we can talk about the definition of preeclampsia now, because proteinuria is one of the, main diagnostic criteria for preeclampsia, although that also changed. And so let's talk about it. Preeclampsia can be defined as systolic pressure greater than 140 and a diastolic greater than 90, again, in two different occasions, 4 hours apart. And then you also include the presence of proteinuria, which is defined as greater or equal to 300 milligrams in 24-hour urine collection. But that's really not a practical test to perform. So they came up with this other test that is the protein creatinine ratio in urine. And if it's greater than 0.3, it's also diagnostic of preeclampsia. Or alternatively, a dipstick of more than 1+, which is sometimes something that can be used in clinics and not very sophisticated places.
Sure.
However, in 2017, if I'm not wrong, the ACOG changed the diagnostic criteria for preeclampsia, and they basically said that proteinuria does not to be present if you also have any of the following. You can have thrombocytopenia, which is a platelet count less than 100,000, renal insufficiency, which is diagnosed as a serum creatinine concentration greater than 1.1, or a creatinine that is doubling. If you have impaired liver function, which is defined as elevated liver transaminase twice normal the concentration, pulmonary edema, or any of the neurologic manifestations of preeclampsia, which can be persistent headache or visual abnormalities. So proteinuria is very important in the diagnosis of preeclampsia, but like I said, it does not have to be present if you have any of the severe features of preeclampsia.
Great. All right. I want to get back to preeclampsia in just one sec, but the final kind of category you mentioned was chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia. And I just want to be clear, I think, tell me if I'm right, that all that means is that you had pre-existing hypertension and now are getting preeclampsia, as opposed to someone who did not have pre-existing hypertension and you're now getting preeclampsia, but the preeclampsia part is still the same, right?
Exactly. And just that, I think the reason the ACOG differentiates these patients is because their, you know, prognosis can be a little bit worse. They can have, you know, worse, let's say worse manifestations of the preeclampsia if it occurs.
Okay. So when we talk about how common preeclampsia is, we already said that quite a lot of 25% of people with preexisting hypertension or gestational hypertension will go on to develop it. But what about when we just look at it in general? How common is it? If you are a woman who is getting pregnant, you are not a hypertensive, you do not develop gestational hypertension, or even if we just talk about all comers of any pregnant woman, what's the chances of developing preeclampsia?
It's around 7 to 8%. 7 to 8% of all the pregnancies in the United States will develop preeclampsia. So it's pretty high.
Okay. And do you have, I mean, I don't know if anyone has kind of, you know, or if it's easy to tease this number out, but for people, I mean, obviously of that 7-8%, a large proportion are going to be people with either pre-existing hypertension or gestational hypertension. Do you have any idea how many people, like if you get past 20 weeks of pregnancy and you're not hypertensive, you weren't before and you now have not developed gestational hypertension, you must have a much lower risk.
Yes, I honestly don't know the actual number, but I assume that yes.
Okay. So
I think my residents will not believe that it's only 7%, because like the majority of the patients that we have, you know, have preeclampsia. So it seems to be more common than that, but we also have like, you know, higher risk pregnancies in our institution. Yeah.
Right. So the people who are high risk are coming to see academic centers like yours and mine, whereas in a, maybe a private practice type setting or, you know, a home birth type setting, you're going to have healthy patients who, hopefully at least, healthy patients who are at lower risk.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So it's fairly common, and it's something we want to be very careful of. We talked about the definition, which is all the kind of things you said. So traditionally, I remember learning when I was in medical school, the requirement for the proteinuria, but as you said, that changed. So you certainly can qualify with proteinuria, but you can also qualify with these other things. So mm-hmm. you have to have the elevated blood pressure, right? You cannot have preeclampsia without a blood pressure greater than 140 over 90 on a couple of occasions. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. The blood pressure is a must. What changed was the presence of proteinuria.
Okay. So you have to have the blood pressure, and then you can have either blood pressure plus the proteinuria, as you said, greater than or equal to 300 milligrams of protein over 24 hours, or these much more convenient ways to measure it. So protein to creatinine ratio of greater than 0.3 or a dipstick greater than 1+. So those are the protein qualifications. And then you listed the variety of things that can also qualify you in, even if you don't have protein, like low platelets, elevated creatinine or doubling creatinine, elevated LFTs, pulmonary edema, or neurologic changes.
Exactly. And those are known as like severe features.
Okay. So, and when you say, so it used to be, and I don't know if this is true anymore, but again, when I was learning about this as a medical student, there was preeclampsia and then severe preeclampsia. Is that still the nomenclature or has that changed?
No, that changed. And the ACOG changed this definition basically because they don't want people to think that a patient diagnosed with mild preeclampsia is a patient that cannot, you know, become severe. So basically, this is a multisystemic disease that can progress very quickly and very unpredictable. So by changing the definition, they are basically trying to make physicians more aware of like the severity of the disease.
Okay. So if you have preeclampsia, let's say you have an elevated blood pressure and you meet the protein criteria, but you don't have any of those things that you just said were called severe features.
Mm-hmm.
And then you develop some of those things, those severe features. Does your definition change? Do you now have preeclampsia with severe features or
That's
no?
correct. That's correct. So the definition changed from preeclampsia with severe features or preeclampsia without severe features. Okay. But by doing that, you're not like, you know, putting the patient on a spectrum of mild disease. You're still considering preeclampsia without severe features as a severe disease, if that makes sense.
Yeah, this strikes me as similar to the change in the sepsis nomenclature, where we used to have sepsis and severe sepsis, and we got rid of severe sepsis because we didn't want anyone thinking that sepsis wasn't severe.
Correct. It's very similar to that. That's a great example.
Okay. So you can have preeclampsia with or without severe features. Is there, there used to also be, you know, to qualify you back when they used to have severe preeclampsia, you could kind of cross another protein ratio. Does that still happen? Like enough protein now counts as a severe feature or no?
No, No, the proteinuria is just like the 300 milligrams in 24-hour collection or the protein in creatinine ratio more than 0.3.
Okay.
It's enough to make the diagnosis.
Great. All right. So we talked about the definition. So you have to meet those criteria and that gets you the diagnosis. What puts, we talked about a major risk factor, which is either pre-existing hypertension or gestational hypertension. Are there other risk factors that people should know about?
Yes, there are plenty, actually. Before we jump into that, I do want to make another differentiation that in preeclampsia can be early onset or preeclampsia can be late onset. So preeclampsia that is early onset is the one that is present before 34 weeks. And this one has a very high genetic component. So that may be one of the risk factors that we're about to talk about.
Great.
Now, preeclampsia that occurs late during pregnancy, meaning more than 34 weeks, after 34 weeks, it has a different side, a different spectrum of risk factors. So for this type of preeclampsia, the one that occurs late, patients that are obese, that have chronic hypertension, that have diabetes, that have chronic kidney disease, are at high risk of developing preeclampsia. Early onset preeclampsia, like I mentioned before, has a very strong genetic component. So if you, somebody in your family had a history of preeclampsia, or if you had preeclampsia on a previous pregnancy, you have a higher risk of developing it.
Okay. So of all patients who get preeclampsia, how many, you know, what percent are early versus late?
Around only 20% of the patients are early.
Okay.
So that leaves 80% of the patients that are, you know, present later.
Okay, so very much more common to present after 34 weeks.
Correct.
And then it can present, including postpartum, right? So how far postpartum can you still get preeclampsia?
So around 8 weeks postpartum, you can also be diagnosed with preeclampsia. And that's actually very important that you mentioned this because a lot of people tend to be, and this was like also something that we used to believe in the past that the delivery of the baby and delivery of the placenta was an absolute cure. However, there are patients that manifest with preeclampsia for the first time postpartum. So, for example, I always tell my residents when they go and evaluate a patient with a postpartum headache, always assume that the patient, don't always assume that the patient is having a postdural puncture headache. Think about other causes of headache because women in general are more prone to headaches. And always when you go see a patient with a headache, make sure that you're looking at the patient's last blood pressures because that can be a manifestation of postpartum preeclampsia.
Okay. And how common is that? I mean, is it, I would imagine, but I don't know this for sure, that it's much more common to develop preeclampsia between 34 and 40 weeks than it is to get it postpartum.
Yeah, it's only around 5% of the patients that are diagnosed postpartum.
Okay. So and that's not nothing. So, you know, certainly, as you said, really important for practitioners to keep that in mind. Okay.
Yes.
So early, which is less common, before 34 weeks, late, which is the most common, after 34 weeks, and then postpartum, which is significantly less common, but still can happen. And as you said, the early is really much more genetically related. The late is going to be related to some of those other risk factors, obesity, hypertension, diabetes, chronic kidney disease.
Mm-hmm. And other risk factors that are important to measure at advanced maternal age, teenage pregnancies, patients with autoimmune disorders like lupus or antiphospholipid syndrome, patients that have multiple gestations, let's say twins or triplets, and patients that did IVF, in vitro fertility for, you know, to get pregnant.
Oh, interesting. So I knew about all of those, except I had not heard about IVF as a risk factor. Do we have any idea why that's a risk factor?
Yes. So there's one of the theories of the pathogenesis of preeclampsia involves an immunologic response, you know, that the mother kind of like creates an immunologic response to the placenta. And so because IVF is not like a natural way of getting pregnant, it is believed that the immunologic response is stronger in this kind of patients.
Interesting. Okay. And I assume they've looked at this independently from the fact that IVF is probably more commonly producing multiple gestations, because that would be a confounder, obviously. If you just looked at all IVF without controlling for number of gestations, it would look like it was a risk factor because you're more likely to have, you know, two or three, twins or triplets when you have IVF than you do when you just have a normal pregnancy.
Correct. And there's another aspect of this now that I remember. Sometimes a lot of people that do IVF, like, for example, same-sex couples, they use sperm donor. And so there's an interesting theory that the father component also plays a role in the development of preeclampsia. And women that are, like, frequently exposed to their partner's semen, they have a less likelihood of developing preeclampsia. So by using donor semen, sometimes you are at increased risk.
Interesting. So that makes a lot of sense, too, as to why that would be a risk factor. Okay. So, great. We've talked about risk factors. And then, so we've looked at one potential or a couple of different kind of pathophysiologic processes. So one is related to genetics. One is potentially related to an immunologic response. Tell me a little more. What do we know about the pathophysiology of preeclampsia?
Okay, so the pathophysiology of preeclampsia is believed to start in the placenta. And basically what happens is that there's impaired remodeling of the spiral arteries, which are, the spiral arteries are the end branches of the uterine arteries that provide the blood supply to the placenta. So normally, in a normal pregnancy, there has to be like this invasion of the myometrium by the spiral arteries, but this involves a lot of mediators, right? So the arteries basically have to dilate and invade the myometrium, so there's like more... there's less resistance and there's more availability of delivering nutrients to the baby. And these arteries that undergo this remodeling are actually unresponsive to vasoactive stimulus. So they remain dilated. They remain open so you can deliver nutrients to that fetus that is growing, if that makes sense. During preeclampsia, this remodeling does not occur normally. So the arteries, the spiral arteries, remain small and constricted, and they're hyper-responsive to vasoactive stimuli. So they don't deliver enough nutrients to the fetus. And then there's decreased placental perfusion. There's small placental infarcts. Overall, less blood supply to the fetus, so there's increased risk of IUGR. And... because this can, you know, this the fetus is going to continue to grow. This can worsen as the pregnancy progresses. Another important component of the pathophysiology of the disease is that when all this remodeling is not occurring, there's also a release of anti-angiogenic factors into the maternal circulation. And so this is why we consider preeclampsia a widespread endothelial dysfunction. And so that's when the patients start developing hypertension and proteinuria and the other manifestations of preeclampsia. Because at this point, we have endothelial dysfunction all over the body, not just in the placenta.
Interesting. So yeah, I kind of, in a much less sophisticated understanding, have conceptualized it in my head of essentially these spiral arteries didn't form and didn't penetrate the way they were supposed to. There's not enough nutrients, blood being delivered to the baby. And so the fetus needs more. And so somehow triggers essentially, you know, the mother's blood pressure to go up to try to deliver more. Is there something coming from the fetus? Is that right? That the fetus is somehow, or I guess the fetus or the placenta is somehow, you know, releasing a some sort of tropic factor or some sort of signaling molecule that is creating elevated blood pressure in an attempt to get more delivery?
Yes, it is. I'm not sure if it's the fetus itself. It's more like the placenta, and this whole, you know, failure to remodel triggers like this cascade of, you know, release of all these factors into the maternal circulation that cause increased high blood pressure, that cause impaired, you know, renal function, cerebral abnormalities, all these things.
Okay. Now, I should have asked you about this before, but at what point does HELLP syndrome come into this? Do we think of HELLP as kind of, and HELLP, I should say, stands for, I believe, hemolysis, elevated liver enzymes, and low platelets. So those are, I mean, you mentioned the low platelets as one of the severe features. You mentioned the elevated liver enzymes as one of the severe features. We didn't mention hemolysis, but is that HELLP syndrome, kind of a thought to be a further progression of preeclampsia, kind of on the, just the more severe spectrum, or is it its own thing?
It's kind of like its own disease. Yeah. However, it is usually, you know, included in the spectrum of preeclamptic disorders. Preeclampsia and HELLP syndrome are usually included in the same category, but HELLP syndrome is like a different disorder on its own.
Mm-hmm. Are you more at risk for HELLP syndrome if you have preeclampsia?
Yes, you are.
Okay.
I don't know the exact amount of risk, but yes, you are at high risk.
Okay. And then I also remember learning about acute fatty liver of pregnancy as a very bad thing. Is that related to either preeclampsia or HELLP syndrome?
That can occur with or without both disorders. But yes, that is a very catastrophic disorder. But it sometimes occurs in people that have no preeclampsia or no HELLP syndrome.
Okay, interesting. All right. So we have this pathophysiology that you talked about. And this has all kind of been elucidated, I think, relatively recently. We haven't known about a lot of this kind of what preeclampsia actually is for very long, I think. Are we pretty confident now? We think that this kind of failure of the spiral arteries to penetrate the myometrium correctly, that is kind of what generally accepted as the cause?
Yes, that's what triggers the whole, you know, disease. But there's a lot more that we don't know about the pathophysiology of preeclampsia. And this is an area of extensive research right now, because this is the area that we have to know very well so we can try to prevent the disease, right? So, for example, right now, one of the most important preventive measures that we're starting to use is the use of aspirin. So the reason why we use aspirin is because in preeclampsia, there's an increase in tranexamic acid thromboxane A2 relative to prostacycline. So if you remember, thromboxane A2 is a potent vasoconstrictor, whereas prostacycline is a potent vasodilator. And so when we give patients aspirin, we inhibit the thromboxane A2 and we can help reduce the risk of preeclampsia. So there's a lot of other mediators, not just thromboxane A2. There's a lot of other mediators that are being researched right now to try to, prevent the development of preeclampsia.
Interesting. So who gets aspirin? Is it people who are at high risk because of pre-existing hypertension or gestational hypertension? Or, how do we decide who gets aspirin as a prevention?
All of the patients that we discussed as risk factors, like advanced maternal age, teenage pregnancies, obese patients, patients with diabetes, they all are getting aspirin starting at 16 weeks.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. What dose of aspirin? A baby or a full dose?
It's baby aspirin, 81 milligrams of aspirin daily.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And they started at, you said, how many weeks?
16.
16
ideally, weeks. Ideally should be started very early, before the 20-week, mark.
And then they continue it until delivery, or even up in, do they continue it for that 8 weeks postpartum, or how far do they go?
They do. They continue it postpartum as well.
Okay. Interesting. So aspirin, and you explained the mechanism there with the thromboxane A2, kind of trying to get that prostacycline versus thromboxane A2 back into a better balance. Are there other preventative measures? You said there's others being looked at. Anything that we're actually doing?
No, there wasn't. Another study that tried to study the use of vitamin C in the prevention of preeclampsia, because vitamin C is an antioxidant. And there were some studies that believed that one of the mechanisms of developing of preeclampsia was an increase in oxygen reactive species, secondary to those all these vasoconstriction and kind of like ischemia. So they were trying to prevent the development of severe preeclampsia with high doses of vitamin C. But unfortunately, the studies were not very promising and didn't show great results. And we unfortunately don't have any other preventive measurements right now. But like I said, this is an area that is being extensively researched.
Okay. So let me ask you this. I mean, this may seem like a really obvious, basic question, but why is preeclampsia bad? And what I mean is, there are non-pregnant people walking around with blood pressures over 140 or diastolics over 90 all the time. I mean, that's obviously, hypertension is very common. Poorly treated hypertension is very common. And there are, you know, long-term consequences to this, but, you know, from the on a day-to-day basis, these people are probably just fine. What is it about having this elevated blood pressure, maybe with some of these, you know, features that's bad? Now, the ultimate kind of move to eclampsia is seizures, right? So is it that it? Is it that preeclampsia is bad because you might end up with seizures? Or in and of itself, is there a reason that having that elevated blood pressure with some proteinuria or other symptoms, even without seizures, is bad?
Yes, well, preeclampsia is bad, first of all, because you don't have just the mother, right? You have a fetus there. And like we mentioned early, if you don't have enough fetal placental perfusion, that fetus is not going to grow. And if a fetus is not growing properly, you can have IUGR, you can have prematurity, and you can have even intrauterine fetal demises. So that's the main reason. Because we also mentioned that preeclampsia, it's actually a multisystemic disease with endothelial damage. These patients can develop pulmonary edema, they can develop renal insufficiency, and then they can develop DIC. And ultimately, yes, they can develop eclampsia or strokes. Hemorrhagic strokes is actually the highest risk of mortality associated with preeclampsia.
Interesting. Okay. So yeah, I think the key things you pointed out there are obviously the potential detrimental effects to the fetus that is obviously still developing during this time. And you mentioned IUGR's intrauterine growth restriction or even intrauterine fetal demise. So these, you know, babies are at a higher risk of, these fetuses are at a higher risk of death. So, you know, very, very, lot of downsides associated with preeclampsia. Okay, so when you have a patient, we talked about prevention. Now, let's say you have a patient who is who has these disorders. So let's start with the kind of basic ones. Let's say you've got a patient who comes in to labor and delivery in labor, and they have known either chronic or gestational hypertension without preeclampsia. What are you doing to treat them? And then after that, we'll talk about what you're doing to manage patients with active preeclampsia. So the patient who's just hypertensive, what are you doing? You're controlling their blood pressure, I assume.
Yes. So obviously medications to control blood pressure. Medications that are commonly used during pregnancy are labetalol, hydralazine, and sometimes nifedipine. But the first line are labetalol and hydralazine. And obviously these patients need to be monitored for early detection of worsening symptoms. And also the fetus needs to be monitored just to make sure that, you know, you have reassuring heart rate patterns and all these things.
Great. So obviously people should follow their institutional protocols, but just to give a general idea, let's say you have a patient come in labor, early labor, and the blood pressure is 160 over 100. What's your first dose going to be and of what?
Usually obstetricians usually start with labetalol. And they usually start, they do incremental doses. So patients usually start with like 10 milligrams of labetalol, and they start increasing that dose progressively based on the patient's response.
Okay. And is, let's say a patient is on antihypertensives at home, they haven't taken them. Do you have them take that, or you just put an IV in and start doing IV management?
If the blood pressure is 160 over 100, like you said, they will just put an IV and start managing it at that point.
Because that's pretty, it's pretty high. You want to get that under control as fast as possible. Is that right?
Correct. Yep.
Okay. So for these patients, again, no signs of preeclampsia, just the blood pressure, do they get magnesium?
Well, the patient that you, that particular example with a blood pressure 160 over 100, it's preeclampsia, correct? But no, they don't always get magnesium if it's just blood pressures.
Wait, sorry, why that patient, even with no proteinuria and no other severe features, just having that higher blood pressure qualifies them as preeclampsia?
160 over 100, yes. That's very high.
Okay.
So that's that's a severe feature. That's a very high blood pressure.
Gotcha. So we hadn't talked about that. So tell me, what's the cutoff of blood pressure where it now counts as preeclampsia even without proteinuria?
More than 160 and more than 110. More than 160 systolic and more than 110 diastolic.
Gotcha. Okay. So that is another way to qualify for preeclampsia, is to just have a high enough blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Great. So so let's say let me change my patient then and say 150 over 95. So the patient who's 150 over 95 will get managed for blood pressure, but no magnesium.
No magnesium.
Okay. Now let's turn our attention to patients who have the diagnosis of preeclampsia. So we could go back to my first example, a patient whose blood pressure is, let's say, 165 over 115. So that patient now has preeclampsia by virtue of having a severe enough blood pressure. They're obviously going to get antihypertensives. Are they going to get magnesium?
Yes, they will get magnesium for seizure prophylaxis.
And what is the, obviously it's IV, and is there a common dose? Do you start low and titrate up? How does that work?
So patients usually get a bolus of like 2 to 4 grams, and then they start getting an infusion. And then they will get blood tests to measure a magnesium level. So usually therapeutic levels are around, 6 to 7 milligrams per deciliter. Patients will continue to be monitored for levels and for signs of toxicity. And that way the infusion can be titrated.
Okay. And so I'm definitely aware that commonly tested is the side effects of magnesium and the kind of way that those present. So tell me about those. What do you look for? And I guess let me back up and say, the reason we're giving these preeclamptics magnesium is to prevent seizures. Is that the main reason?
Yes, that is the main reason. Magnesium attenuates the vascular response to pressor substance and dilates the vascular beds in the brain. And so that kind of is believed to be the mechanism behind using magnesium.
Okay.
It's very important to know that it's not an antihypertensive.
Right. And is there some, I have this vague memory of magnesium being thought to also have some kind of neuroprotective effects for the fetus. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true for premature fetuses. Yes, that is true.
Okay. But that's more in the premature fetus. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the side effects of magnesium and how they present.
So it also depends on the magnesium level. But basically, when patients are actually therapeutic, they're going to feel flushed, they're going to feel warm. Some of them are going to complain of nausea. They're going to be a little bit sedated. As the levels progress, patients are going to lose their deep tendon reflexes. That's very important. As the level keep progressing, patients are going to present with arrhythmias. The most important arrhythmias are going to be prolonged PR, widened QRS, heart blocks. And then if we keep going with the infusion, the patients can actually have a respiratory depression and a systole.
Okay. So I think that order is frequently, tested, so that the first things are the loss of the deep tendon reflexes, then changes on the EKG, respiratory depression, and finally, cardiac arrest. Do you think people need to know the levels at which that is expected to happen?
They do. That's a highly tested question, and I encourage all the residents to review that. Yes.
Okay. And is there a general, I have this feeling like around 5 to 10 is where you start to lose the deep tendon reflexes, maybe like 10 to 15, you can see EKG changes and start to get some respiratory depression, 15 to 20, more significant respiratory depression and potentially cardiac arrest is around there or higher. Am I right, or am I completely making this up?
No, you're correct. Around 15 to 20 is respiratory depression and a systole. Loss of deep tendon reflexes can occur, at levels as low as 7, but usually around 9 to 12.
Okay, great. All right, so that is important to know as well. So now let's say you have a preeclamptic in labor, or even just not in labor, but, near term. So let me ask you about that. If they're not in labor, they come in for a routine check, they have the elevated blood pressure, and plus, they've got maybe some severe features. They are going to be induced if they're near term. Is that right?
Yeah, most likely they will be induced.
And is it, you know, is that dependent on the severe feature? So let's say somebody comes in, they're 37 weeks and they have a blood pressure of 145 over 95. Are they going to be induced or kind of watched closely, or, you know, versus, and I mean that as compared to somebody who comes in at, you know, 180 over 120.
Yeah. So there are certain characteristics that, certain patients that are not candidates for expectant management. So we can talk about those. Those are patients that have eclampsia. Obviously, that's an indication for delivery, not necessarily C-section, but a delivery. Patients with pulmonary edema, patients with DIC, patients with renal insufficiency, patients that have placental abruption, or if there's any abnormal fetal testing, those patients need to be delivered immediately, regardless of the gestational age. In other patients that do not have this serious conditions, expectant management can be performed. So these patients need to be admitted and monitored closely, but not necessarily need to be delivered right away.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Yep. So someone with even just preeclampsia without any severe features is still going to get admitted. So these patients don't go home?
It's not likely that they go home. They have to be monitored for development of severe features because, like I said, they can happen very unpredictably. Mm-hmm. And the fetus needs to be monitored.
And is that true also for the people with early? So like someone with 32 weeks who develops preeclampsia, or is it different when it's that early?
No, it's true for everybody. And if the patients have severe blood pressures, you know, these pressures need to be managed, the features need to be monitored, and the patient need to be monitored for the development of severe features. If the patient develops severe features that do not resolve, then indication for delivery is granted at this point.
Okay. And is there anything that is obviously fetal instability is always a potential indication for stat C-section. Is there, in the absence of that, with a stable fetus, is there any feature that would make you take a pregnant woman to stat C-section as opposed to induction? And I mean, I'm imagining a patient in who is having an eclamptic seizure. Does that patient get taken to C-section or potentially still proceed with induction?
Not necessarily. Eclampsia is an indication for delivery, but not necessarily for C-section. So when you have a patient that has an eclamptic seizure, first you have to make sure that, you know, you control the seizures by administering benzodiazepines and that you protect the patient's airway. And obviously you're going to be monitoring the fetus at this point. If the fetus is still, you know, has reassuring fetal heart rate patterns, then you can continue to observe the patient, but this patient needs to be delivered. So whether they induce the patient or they decide to proceed with a C-section, that patient needs to be delivered. That's an indication for delivery, not necessarily cesarean section.
Okay. And then how does your anesthetic management change for a patient with preeclampsia in terms of, do they still get a labor epidural if they are being induced or if they're in labor? And then if they do go to C-section, neuraxial versus GA.
Okay, so it's very important to communicate with the obstetricians regarding the mode of delivery. If a patient is going to be delivered vaginally, if they consider that it's okay to induce that patient, early administration of neuraxial analgesia is recommended, either a continuous epidural, a combined spinal epidural, a dural puncture and epidural. All of these techniques are appropriate. It's recommended to place a catheter early because two things. You can have patients that are having declining platelets, so you want to place it early before the platelets continue to drop. And by treating the pain, you can also decrease the circulating catecholamines that the patient has associated with the excruciating pain, right? And by doing that, you help decrease the blood pressure and improve the uteroplacental perfusion.
That makes sense. So early epidural, control the pain, have it in place before the platelets get low and you wouldn't want to put it in, et cetera. All right. And So do you ever run into a situation where, you know, let's say you get the epidural in and then the preeclampsia gets worse and the platelets, you know, get low, you then can leave it in, but you might have to wait to take it out, right? Because you don't want to take it out when platelets are too low.
Correct. Pulling the epidural catheter also increases the risk for epidural hematoma formation. So you have to be careful at this stage as well. Check platelets and, you know, proceed accordingly.
Okay. And how about when you think about the airway, if you are going to do, you know, how do you decide between neuraxial anesthesia or general anesthesia for a C-section?
So for a C-section, neuraxial anesthesia is preferred because, like you mentioned, general anesthesia, you have to, you know, consider that these patients are going to be very difficult airways. First of all, pregnancy itself causes difficult airway, right? These patients have edema, they have oropharynx friability of all the vessels in the oropharynx and the nasopharynx. So the airways are, you know, difficult per se, but if you add patients that are preeclamptic, that are having proteinuria, they're going to be more edematous. So you don't want to, you know, you don't want to have to deal with a difficult airway. So neuraxial techniques are preferred. And, in this case, you can do, again, spinal, single-shot spinals, or you can do continuous epidurals. Now, if you do have to do general anesthesia, because let's say you have a patient that is comes in with a placental abruption, then you just have to anticipate for a difficult airway, have, you know, smaller size endotracheal tubes, videolaryngoscopes, a fiber optic available. And you also have to consider that laryngoscopy causes a sympathetic response, and you can have a patient actually stroke during this moment. So you have to do things to prevent that hypertensive response to laryngoscopy. So you right. can consider Esmolol, a small bolus of remifentanil is recommended in these patients as well. You know, if the blood pressure is extremely high, you can even consider a small bolus of nitroglycerin. Everything that you can do to prevent that hypertensive response.
Okay, great. So that's really important, and to just recognize, I think, as you said, that these patients' airways are even more difficult, the preeclamptics, than just a traditional pregnant patient, and those we should be treating, you know, as potential difficult airways in and of themselves. So if a patient does have an eclamptic seizure, you said you're going to need to make sure that you're safe from a controlling the airway standpoint, and then obviously treat the seizure, not necessarily with your traditional seizure medications, though it sounds like benzodiazepines are your go-to first. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Benzodiazepines can be administered safely to these patients to terminate a seizure.
And if that doesn't work, is there a next kind of go-to?
So you can also give like a bolus of magnesium sulfate at this point, like around 2 grams of magnesium. If that doesn't help, then you have to consider something like propofol. And then, you know, at that point, you have to intubate your patient.
Right. Okay. All right. So I think that was a great summary. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you think we should?
I think basically, you know, just remind residents that preeclampsia is a progressive disease, that it can present postpartum, that it should not be taken lightly. And just, you know, keep, stay tuned, because there's a lot of research going on the pathophysiology of disease that will like show us some light into preventive measurements.
Great. Well, that'll be really interesting. I mean, I think so much has come to light even in the past 5 to 10 years. And as you say, I think only more is to come. So that will be very exciting. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Do you have something to recommend to the audience, Juanita?
Yes. This time I want to recommend a book. It's called Killers of the Flower Moon by David Gran. This book will actually be a film in 2021 directed by Martin Scorsese and starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro. It's a very interesting nonfiction book that investigated a series of murders that took place in the Osage County in Oklahoma in the 1920s. And it also tells the story of how the FBI was born. It's fascinating because although it's a nonfiction book, the characters almost seem fictional. So there are Texas Rangers, there are robbers, there are private investigators, gangs, you name it. So it's definitely a page turner, and it's very interesting from a history perspective too. So I highly recommend it.
Very cool. And we will put a link to that in the show notes, and I will check it out myself. My recommendation is for a new podcast called Medical Murmurs by an ER physician named Paris Lovett. And his goal is to, he's just launched this and he's released, I think, 3 or 4 different interview podcasts. And what he does is he interviews folks from different fields. So he actually, in full disclosure, he did interview me. And so my episode is up there as an anesthesiologist. But he also has one with a trauma surgeon, one with an ENT surgeon, and there may be some more. And what he does is he talks to them kind of just about their career. And he does a very nice job to kind of explore how they chose their career, what their day is like in that career. So I think this is something that would be really interesting, definitely for medical students. In fact, he does have a separate, he kind of makes a cut for medical students with more specific questions about kind of how they chose the career. And then a more general cut that's a little longer that just has a lot of really interesting discussion. And so I think it'd be great for medical students, but really also for the lay public or anyone who's interested in kind of hearing stories from folks doing different branches of medicine than what some of the others of us may be doing. So anyway, Paris Lovett's Medical Murmurs, worth checking out. All right, Juanita, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Jed, for having me again. It was a pleasure.
All right, fantastic. I love that we're beefing up our OB content, and Dr. Hanau does a fantastic job with it. I always learn a ton, as I'm sure you do. Let us know what you think. You can leave a comment on the website. That's acrac.com, and others can see that and learn from what you have to say as well. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. We're at ACRAC Podcast, and I'm at Jay Wolpaw. And, of course, there's also a Facebook group you are welcome to join. If you are a fan of the show and you haven't already or haven't for a while, please consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you're interested in supporting the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/acrac. That's patreon.com/accrac, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference and we really appreciate it. You can also make a donation anytime by going to paypal.me/acrac. Thank you so much to those who are already patrons and have already made donations. Huge thank you, as always, to our ACRAC intern, Kimia Cash-Cooley, and, of course, to Dr. Brian Park and to April Liu. They're doing a fantastic job putting together outlines for some of the episodes. Our ACRAC original music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. Thank you so much to Dennis for the original music. All right, that is it for today for the ACRAC Podcast and Dr. Juanita Hanau. I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.